Blog Talk Radio.
Hello there, this is Annabelle. I am really, really excited about talking to John Boniface. He is the co-founder and director of Free Speech for the People. And one of the reasons I asked him to...
Hi, Annabelle. How's that?
Oh, good. This show has started, so I'm kind of in the middle of an introduction for you. Thanks for calling. I was just telling everyone that you won this huge victory recently in Montana, and one of the reasons I wanted to invite you today is to kind of give us a lowdown on what happened with this particular case with the Montana Supreme Court and what it means going forward in terms of other states possibly ruling similarly, and if there's going to be a showdown at the Supreme Court and so on. But can you start by actually just saying a little bit about Free Speech for the People as an organization and the work that you did on this particular case?
Absolutely. Thanks, Annabelle, and good to be with you. We at Free Speech for People filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, before the Montana Supreme Court in April of last year on behalf of both Free Speech for People as well as Montana businesses and two national business networks, the American Sustainable Business Council and the American Independent Business Alliance. And we made the argument before the state Supreme Court that the state's longstanding ban on corporate money in elections, known as the Corrupt Practices Act, passed by Montana voters in 1912, a century ago, should be upheld, and that, in fact, it is a pro-business law, that it supports the opportunity for all voices to be heard in the process, and when you allow corporate money into elections, you drown out ordinary citizens and you drown out smaller businesses, and it only allows for the big corporate entities to control our elections and our government. So we came to the defense of the law. We were proud to stand with Attorney General Steve Bullock of Montana in defending the law, and to his credit, you know, he stood up and had the courage to fight up against Citizens United, and he's now created this test case going before the Supreme Court likely this year to revisit Citizens United.
Mm-hmm. So when the Citizens United ruling initially passed almost 2 years ago now, the states that had these laws, did they know that they were supposed to figure out how to align themselves with Citizens United? I mean, what was the reaction back in 2010 to Citizens United? Did they know the implications?
Absolutely. Every state knew the implications, and in fact, most states made clear they were not going to enforce their laws. The only state that stood up on this was Montana, saying they would continue to enforce their law. And the argument that Steve Bullock, the Attorney General of Montana, made is that, in fact, the interests that justify their century-old law were not considered under the Citizens United factual basis, and therefore the Supreme Court's ruling does not apply. Now, that's, you know, an argument they're going to make before the U.S. Supreme Court, but of course, whenever you have a case of this nature go before a court dealing with a prior precedent, it also invites the opportunity to make the argument that the court should revisit its prior ruling and reverse and deal with the arguments that have been put forward demonstrating how the court got it wrong the first time. So I think what we'll see as this case likely goes before the Supreme Court is we'll see both the arguments made by the state of Montana that there are separate constitutional interests that were never considered by Citizens United that provide an exception, if you will, to the Citizens United ruling, perhaps a very big exception that allows states all around the country to implement or enforce these kinds of laws. But that also there will be arguments made that the court should reverse its ruling in Citizens United, that it did in fact get it wrong, and 2 years of factual experience has shown why they got it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Can you, as a lawyer, can you just very briefly tell us what is actually wrong with the Citizens United ruling?
Well, the Citizens United ruling is the most extreme extension of a fabricated doctrine over the past 30 years. It's eroded our First Amendment and our Constitution that says corporations are effectively people with free speech rights and are able to come in and strike down democratically enacted laws to protect the public interest, in this case, to protect our elections. And, you know, that is such a fundamentally wrong approach to what the framers intended, what the Constitution has been about for two centuries. The framers never intended to have corporations be treated as people. James Madison talked of corporations being a necessary evil subject to proper limitations and guards. Thomas Jefferson said he hoped to crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations. And this idea of corporate rights and corporate speech rights in particular is frankly offensive to the idea of democracy and of government of, for, and by the people. We the people rule, not we the corporations. It's people that shall govern, not corporations. And that, I think, is why it's so wrong what the Citizens United ruling has done to this democracy and to our Constitution.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, it's not so much that you're against corporations having any rights, but it's about the fact that we have extended part of our Bill of Rights that we thought was for people, natural living people. And so is that, I mean, am I wrong that your basic argument is that these are rights that should be exclusively for natural living people as opposed to artificially created entities?
Well, you're correct that the focus is around corporate constitutional rights. But to be clear, corporations don't have any rights. I mean, they are entities that are chartered by the state. In every state, there are state corporate charter laws, and these are privileges that they have to exist. They don't have any right to exist. They are able to exist because of state-based corporate charter laws that we, the people, have enacted through our legislatures, and then we govern over them. And all the other privileges that they have following their ability to be chartered emanate from that. They don't have any rights. Now, when it comes to, you know, the ability to engage in contractual relationships, to treat it as people under state and federal laws so that we can hold them accountable, for example, under the Clean Air Act, yeah, we want to treat them as people. But these are, again, privileges that we provide them, or responsibilities, if you will, that we provide them in the case of the Clean Air Act instance, that they need to follow. But they are artificial entities. We create them. We govern them, not the other way around.
Now, okay, just if you could help us get a historical perspective here. Okay, 1912, Montana passed the Corrupt Practices Act, and it's 2012. And, well, 2010 is when Citizens United ruling passed. Now, in the roughly 100-year period, what happened? Like, what's been the significant change? Is it a change in our attitude? Is it a change in our relationship to government or corporations? Like, what's gone wrong? Because it seems like this Montana rule, which passed, you know, nearly 100 years ago, is much more progressive and in line with our values and Citizens United ruling.
Right. Well, what happened here is that corporate America decided it was going to go into court and invent this fabricated doctrine to fight back against a growing set of public interest laws that were getting passed by the federal and state governments across the country. And that's really what happened. Lewis Powell, a private attorney at the time working for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, wrote an infamous memorandum in 1971 laying out this strategy of how, in fact, corporate America could respond to the growing set of environmental laws, health care laws, consumer rights laws, other public interest laws that were getting passed in that era. And his idea was to go into court and argue there's a First Amendment corporate speech right that is implicated by these laws, and that we can use this corporate speech right to strike down these laws. And so, you know, you have a growing corporatist agenda on the Supreme Court. Lewis Powell became Justice Lewis Powell and became an architect of this doctrine on the Supreme Court. And for the 30-year period that we've seen since then, we've seen a series of these corporate rights cases. But you're right, this is not the bulk of our history in this country. In fact, if anything, we have a history that goes the other way in terms of where the framers were and what people envisioned for our country and for our Constitution. But this is really an agenda that's been pushed by big corporations and their agents, and they succeeded for a number of years until, they finally, I think, reached the final straw here with the Citizens United case. I think it was just so over the top that people are finally waking up to it and responding and seeing what's wrong with this overall idea of corporate personhood under the Constitution.
Yeah. I think it's been a shock, actually, for people who either heard about it back in 2010 or have in the past couple of years heard about it. When just hear the rough description of it is just on its face so shocking and if not insulting, that it has been a good way to wake people up. I can assure you we talk about Citizens United a lot in the coffee party. But I'm just curious, how do you respond to people? Because I have to respond to this myself to people, is like they feel that our government is so compromised by this problem, the money and politics issue. It's just no longer belongs to the people right now. And they don't think there's enough time to go through this kind of usual legal procedural journey to correct this problem, that and this is why the Occupy movement was kind of instigated, was because we need to do something much more radical, more dramatic to turn the tide and shift power back to the people. How do you respond to that sense of urgency that people have?
Well, I share it. I believe we have that urgency. We have to work to do what we can to preserve our democracy and our republic. And I think all the activity that's happening around the country toward that end is all important and crucial. I don't think there's only one way to do this. I do believe that a constitutional amendment has to be the overarching call. The fact is that there are only two ways to overturn a Supreme Court ruling, or in this case, a Supreme Court doctrine. And one way is to have the Supreme Court itself enunciate that doctrine is overturned, which, of course, in the near future is unlikely given the makeup of the court. Or alternatively, it's to have a constitutional amendment to overturn that ruling and that doctrine. And we've done this before in our nation's history, 27 times before, seven times to overturn egregious Supreme Court rulings. And constitutional amendment fights are ways that we can unite people around common principles, in this case, the principle of government of, for, and by the people. And all the other actions that are being pushed forward, I think, are assisted by the overall framing of a constitutional amendment fight.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are many proposals out there, Bernie Sanders, Don Edwards, Sheldon Whitehouse, many representatives in Congress have proposed amendments, and that's part of the issue. I think there's a lot of confusion about which one to support and which one gets the language right. Is there one that you personally feel is the best one that's already been submitted in Congress?
Well, in actuality, our People's Rights Amendment, which is the only one that completely overturns corporate personhood and makes clear that all corporations are not people with constitutional rights, that has been introduced by Congressman Jim McGovern. It is a bipartisan constitutional amendment bill, one of only two of the bills in Congress right now that's bipartisan, with Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina, Republican, on it, as well as a number of other prominent members of Congress. And that's the one we're backing, and people can learn more about it at peoplesrightsamendment.org or our website, freespeechforpeople.org. I would encourage people to read about it, but it basically makes clear that corporations are not people with constitutional rights. There are variations on this. There are bills that try to carve out an exception for nonprofit corporations. So only for-profit corporations would no longer be treating as people, but nonprofit corporations could still have the rights of corporate personhood. We don't agree with that approach, but we understand there are those out there who think that's something to advocate for. There's also a separate approach that is really going to a different doctrine that needs to get overturned, and that's the doctrine of money equaling speech. And Senator Udall's bill, Tom Udall from New Mexico's bill, would overturn that doctrine and allow for Congress and the states to set limits on overall campaign spending. And we've come out in support of that, and frankly, I think those two amendment bills, the McGovern bill and the Udall bill, are complementary to each other, and we can have a 28th and 29th amendment to the Constitution. We've actually done amendments in clusters in the past. So I think that's a way to look at this. But, you know, all the activity in Congress and around the country demonstrates the vibrancy of this movement. I think, you know, the more debate on this, the better. But yes, we are advocating for a clear and straightforward amendment bill that doesn't have exceptions and overturns all of corporate personhood, not just the question of corporations in the political process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about the question about the public financing of campaigns? Because I know there are some people who believe that that's really the only solution to this.
Yeah. So I've been a long-time advocate for that. You know, I've actually mm-hmm. worked on the issue for over a decade. I believe in public funding of campaigns. You know, it's not clear to me that a constitutional amendment is needed for it. I mean, the states of Maine, Arizona, Connecticut mm-hmm. all have public funding elections. There was never a constitutional amendment needed. We had public funding of elections for presidential cycles until more recently when people started opting out. We didn't need a constitutional amendment for it. Where we need a constitutional amendment is if we're going to mandate that everybody participate in a public funding system, or that that Congress somehow must provide it via a constitutional amendment. That would be the way do that. But you know, you don't need 2/3 of Congress to pass a bill for mm-hmm. public funding of elections. So it's unclear to me why an amendment's needed for that. But I'm open to the idea that we should make it mandatory that everybody should participate in it, and that we shouldn't allow anyone to opt out. And that would be, I think if we did that, that would be an amendment, not a voluntary public funding system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I have another sort of legalese kind of question and then sort of broader strategic political question. I mean, the first one is, right now, with Citizens United ruling, would Fair Elections Now Act, would that be a challenge, do you think, legally by the Citizens United ruling? So in other words, like with one of the things that happened this past year was the Supreme Court striking down the Arizona Clean Election Law. And I guess the worry is that if we did pass something like Fair Elections, that it would also be struck down by this Supreme Court. Is that true?
Well, first of all, the Arizona case, to be clear, was not about whether the entire law could be struck down. The law is still in effect. What was struck down was the matching provision that allowed the state to match any candidate going outside the system with additional funds.
Okay.
And the Supreme Court, in my view, wrongly decided that it somehow chills the speech of those outside the system, and the state can't, you know, add matching funds beyond the grants that they provide. But they actually made clear in that decision that they weren't deciding on the grant type system, meaning, you know, an initial set of grants that would go to candidates who qualify. So I'm not sure that the Fair Elections Now Act would get struck down if it didn't have a matching provision. Having said that, you know, I think it's true that the court has shown its willingness to overturn repeatedly campaign finance laws, and I'm not opposed to the notion that as part of this constitutional amendment mm-hmm. movement, we include, you know, a bill like the Yarmuth bill, Congressman Yarmuth's bill, that mandates public funding of elections. I think that can be certainly part of the mix. But I just think, you know, for those friends of ours who are engaged in pushing the Fair Elections Now Act,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think it's important to highlight that that Congress can pass that today without having to have an amendment in place.
Okay, that's good to know. So the real worry, though, John, is that this Supreme Court is not really in the business of or focused on their mission of interpreting the law. It's more, it feels like it's a very political activist court. And I guess that's why people are so concerned that, and there's, I think, just tremendous anxiety that we don't really know what's coming. It's kind of unpredictable, just like Citizens United was kind of shocking and unpredictable. So I guess that's why, even with the amendment, if we did pass an amendment, with this court that is kind of, I don't know, so political and so activist that it's, I feel like it may defy kind of the conventional understanding of laws, even new amendments that are passed. I guess so the question is, John, like, do you think this court is so activist and political that we're basically in danger here?
I do think that this court has shown a willingness to go after these kinds of laws with a frankly dishonest reasoning, and mm-hmm. I do think it shows we've got to use the constitutional amendment process to respond. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think you're right that there's a danger that any kind of amendment that that gets enacted, if it doesn't include, language that supports public funding, then, you know, maybe they would try to strike that down. Having said that, any amendment that makes clear money doesn't equal speech effectively takes away what argument they might try to come up with public funding. You know, mm-hmm. that essentially has been the way they've gone after public funding, at least thus far, is to make a speech argument.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is something new with the Citizens United ruling, the money equals speech, right?
That was Buckley v. Vallejo, 1976. Mm-hmm. So, look, this is one thing that does get stated a lot that I think needs to be corrected. People say Citizens United found that money equals speech. That's actually not true. Citizens
right.
United did not rule that. That was decided a number of years ago in 1976 in Buckley v. Vallejo. Citizens United repeated that idea and followed that precedent, but it was not Citizens United that set up that ruling.
Mm-hmm. Okay, no, that's good to clarify. I mean, so right now, okay, the strategic question is, how long would it take to pass this amendment? Because that's another response that I'm sure you've heard, is this is going to just take too long. Could we just go the legislative route? Why do we have to have an amendment?
Well, first of all, as I said, an amendment is necessary if we want to overturn the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling or U.S. Supreme Court doctrine. You cannot legislatively overturn U.S. Supreme Court. That's just the constitutional framework we have. Congress can't pass a law that says the Supreme Court's wrong. It has to pass an amendment if it wants to overturn a Supreme Court ruling. So that's number one. Number two, how long will it take? I mean, you know, it's hard to know with any amendment how long it will take. It took less than 2 years to lower the age, the voting age, from 21 to 18 back in the 1970s. Now, that was during the height of the Vietnam War, and people were being sent off to fight and die, but were not able to vote. And I think that was a major impetus for that amendment. But, you know, one could see how the clamoring around the danger associated with corporations being treated as people and corporate money elections could rise to such a crescendo in a short period of time that an amendment could happen. That being said, it's also important to look at other amendment struggles that have taken much longer. And, you know, we don't have a crystal ball. It's impossible, obviously, to know how long this will take. Could 5 years, could take 10 years, could take more than that. But Senator Paul Wellstone has often, you know, said when he was alive, you can't win a fight unless you start it. And this is a fight we've got to start. And it may take a while, but at this stage, it's going to take potentially a fewer number of years than it would waiting around for a new Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. But you agree with this strategy that that's going on right now with local city councils passing resolutions. It just happened in New York. It happened in L.A. It happened in Albany. Many other local level city councils and even some state legislatures are considering passing a resolution to really defy and reject Citizens United. You basically, that's the ticket forward in terms of...
Well, it's one of the tickets, and we're part of it at freespeechforpeople.org. We have a resolution before the state legislature in New Mexico, another one in Massachusetts, one in Washington State. We're definitely engaged in pushing at the local level for these resolutions as well, along with other groups, including the Coffee Party. But there are other avenues we have to pursue at the same time. I mean, the fact that the Supreme Court is now going to take up this very question that it dealt with 2 years ago provides an entire new opportunity to push the message out of what the court did and how wrong it was. And we intend to be very engaged in that work as well, marshaling amici briefs from around the country, a communication strategy that's combined with it to help demonstrate why the court was wrong. In addition, you know, we think it's important to build support within the business community. So we're building support from business leaders around the country, and we've partnered with the American Sustainable Business Council on that. We have nearly 1,000 business leaders calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. We also think it's important to build support within the legal community, and we've built a letter with former government attorneys and prominent constitutional law professors on board calling for the consideration of a constitutional amendment. And, you know, finally, we also have used the power to revoke a corporate charter as an educational vehicle to demonstrate that we, the people, rule, not we, the corporations. And we've joined with Appalachian Voices and Rainforest Action Network in calling for the revocation of the Massey Energy corporate charter, the coal company that was responsible for the 29 coal miners who were killed in West Virginia last year. So we do believe that there are, you know, many ways to approach this, and those are some of the ways we're engaged at freespeechforpeople.org in this fight.
I want to, first of all, just thank you for all the work you're doing. I mean, this is amazing. It really, when I heard about this Montana Supreme Court ruling, it gave me so much hope. So thank you for that. Before you go, I want to just see if you could answer these two questions really quickly. I know how difficult this work is. Like, what do you find the most challenging about this work? And the second question is, like, what gives you hope? What keeps you going?
Well, certainly the most challenging is building the necessary resources and infrastructure for what's needed. And, you know, we're engaged along with many other groups in I think, building this movement. But there's no question that to take it to the next level, there needs to be even more resources available so we can have the kind of staffing and capability to really capture the momentum that's already there and take it to a new place. And, you know, that's the challenge, and we are engaged in it on a daily basis with prospective funders and current ones. I think that what gives us the greatest hope is really the fact that people all over the country are standing up and fighting back. Wherever I've gone, there's energy, you know, in every room that I'm walking into on this issue, in every locality, every event, there's a ton of interest and public imagination around this, and people really do believe in the promise of democracy and the promise of America, and they want to fight to preserve it. They want to fight back and stand up, and I treasure that, and it's a privilege to be working with people like you, Annabelle, and everyone around the nation who cares so deeply about these basic fundamental American principles.
Yeah, well, I mean, I how long have you been working on this, John?
Well, I've been in the field of democracy advocacy for over 2 decades, and started an organization called the National Voting Rights Institute back in 1994 that worked on the question of money and politics as a civil rights issue of our time. But this particular campaign to call for a constitutional amendment was launched the day of the Citizens United ruling, actually moments after the ruling. We were preparing for the likelihood the court would go over the cliff as it did, and we wanted to be ready to respond right away.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Well, I again, thank you so much, John. And Can you say your URL one more time? freespeechforthepeople.org?
Actually, just freespeechforpeople.org, no V. So freespeechforpeople.org, and we invite people all around the nation to join us and help us reclaim our democracy.
Okay, well, thanks, John.
Thanks so much, Annabelle.
I'll
good to talk.
I'll be seeing you soon. Yeah, great talking to you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. We are going to transition over to talking to Kevin Zies from Occupy Washington, also known as October Movement. And I just want to remind you guys that if you want to talk, you have to push one. Otherwise, I'm not sure if you're calling in to listen or to join the conversation. So I think this is Kevin, 301 number.
Hey,
hi,
how are you doing?
This is Kevin
Zies. Yes,
hey,
how are you doing?
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for joining us.
Good to hear your voice. I'm glad you had John before. He's doing good work on the Move to Amend and Get Money Out Politics stuff.
Yeah. They just won a huge victory. He's with Free Speech for People, by the way. But they got the Montana Supreme Court to defy the Supreme Court.
Right, that's great. That's
amazing. So as a lawyer, I'm sure you can understand how excited John must be about this victory.
Victories are so few and far between. You got to celebrate them all.
I know. So, Kevin, I'm so glad to check in with you. I was thrilled to get your email about sort of outlining phase two of Occupy Washington, D.C. at Freedom Plaza and all the work that you guys have been doing and now building on and the momentum that you're capitalizing on. So I'm really eager to get everyone to hear the download or lowdown, I should say, about what's been going on and your plans for the future. So can you just kind of spell it out for us? Like what's
sure.
been going on and what's phase two?
Sure. Well, yeah, we have been thinking about phase two for a while, and we've been working on it. And after discussions among our General Assembly and with our web community, we've come to some great ideas, I think, and we're now in the process of implementing them. What we have is three encampments now. We have to continue to have the encampment on Freedom Plaza, which remains kind of the public spotlight for the Occupy movement to show people taking back the public space and trying to talk about what the Commonwealth is that we all share. And so having that out there for the public to see and participate in is a critical part of the continued effort. Then we have two houses. We have the Peace House, which is on 12th and M. It's called the Peace House because for the last 30 years there's been an encampment outside of the White House, a vigil, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year against nuclear war and seeking disarmament. And the people who own the Peace House and who continue that vigil are in the Peace House. And so we've taken that Peace House over now, and we have a lease option. We're looking for investors, by the way. It's a fantastic deal, a guaranteed moneymaker for anyone who has to invest in it, but they can contact me about that if they're interested. We have one investor. We're looking for one other. But out of the Peace House, we're going to be organizing the National Occupation of Washington. It's going to begin on March 30th. It's going to be a combination of a social forum where people come with their experiences, their information to share, and we all build a strong network on which to grow the Occupy movement with a lot of knowledge and education, as well as protest. And we're going to be protesting the power structure in Washington, D.C., including the Congress. And that will be beginning on March 30th. No end date is set. That will go for as we see appropriate, just as the Occupy movement has been acting in other circumstances. So we see this as a long-term effort of education, organizing, and mobilizing people. Then we have a third encampment, a second house, in Mount Rainier, Maryland, which is just on the border of Washington, D.C. And out of that house, we're doing what we're calling Occupy the Economy. And Occupy the Economy is beginning to show the public and alternative democratic institutions for things like worker-owned cooperatives. In fact, we're focusing on cooperatives because this year is the International Year of Cooperatives, according to the U.N., and we're forming worker-owned cooperatives. You could call them occupier-owned cooperatives, I guess. So occupiers can make some money, continue to use their skills to build the movement and also raise money for the movement as well, mm-hmm. plus showing people that there are alternatives to the top-down corporate model and move instead to a more linear worker-owned model where people have more control of their own economic lives. And so we're trying to set that example. We're also working on an Occupy television show, which we'll be announcing as it develops. And so a lot of exciting projects. We see this as phase two, and we think that I was up at Wall Street last week, and I see Occupy Wall Street's playing their next 6 months as well. I've heard from occupiers around the country that they're planning events too. So I think the spring is going to be quite exciting for the Occupy movement. If the elites were upset and concerned about the first 3 months of Occupy in our toddler months, when they see us in our terrible teenage years, it's going to be even more shocking to them. So people should get ready and get involved. And if you want to find out more about this, OccupyWashingtonDC.org is our website. You can get on there and read about our plans. In fact, Margaret Flowers and I put up an article today about where we came from, the Occupy movement, and where we see it going. And you can comment on that and give your own ideas. We, you know, it's obviously we're just one person's opinion. And so we want to get other people's opinions on it as well. And we see it as a real opportunity to influence the direction of the country. So hope people join in and get involved.
Yeah, well, definitely. So you're not using the October2011.org anymore? Is that...
Well, we started, you know, as you know, Annabelle, we started organizing our event in the last March, and we went public in June before there was an Occupy movement. We were modeling ourselves after activities in Spain and the Arab Spring and Greece and so Europe and in the Arab countries. And in those countries, they use the kind of a date and time kind of approach. So October 2011 was modeled after their approach. When Occupy DC, Wall Street began, and the media and the activists started using the Occupy terminology, we just changed our name to Americanize it to OccupyWashingtonDC.org. And so it's the same organization, just used the Americanized name rather than the European and Arab name, which is moved away from the month and the year approach.
Okay. Now, that's fine. I just wanted to get some clarity because we've been promoting the that URL. But, okay, so, Kevin, one of the things I really want to talk to you about is it's really a question about strategy.
Okay? Yeah.
Because I know how strategic you and Margaret are and how experienced you are in terms of having tried different tactics and gone down different venues and worked with many organizations and so on. I know you have that experience and you've thought a lot about the strategy. There was a lot of planning that went into your occupation, unlike the Occupy movement. I know you kind of laid the groundwork before it started. So I'm just trying to understand the strategy right now.
Sure.
I know that initially it was the idea was to stop what you said, stop the machine, the power structure as it is right now, and then to really form alternatives, create a new
right.
world, put it. Is that
right.
still the strategy? And
when we started working on this in March, we did a lot to prepare before we came out in October. And one of the things we did to prepare was we did a lot of reading and research and talking to people who have a lot of experience on how nonviolent movements actually shift power to the people. And that's our goal, to end corporate rule and shift power to the people. It's essentially end the rule of 1% and shift power to 99%. And what you find when you read this and study this is that there are certain columns, I'd say, or power structures that hold the status quo in place.
Mm-hmm.
And for us to achieve a shift of power, we have to weaken those columns. And those columns are things like the media, business, military, police, workers, youth, faith groups, non-government organizations or nonprofits, and civil servants. And so what we do is to weaken those power structures, what you want to do is pull people from those areas to your side.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and our idea, for example, of the worker-owned co-ops is to strengthen the workers so they can see it as an alternative economy, that they don't be afraid of the change that's coming, that the change will benefit them. So they
yeah.
come to our side. They can see that they're going to have more power, more control of their lives. It also weakens the business, the current business model, by taking people out of the corporate economic structure. On the media, you and I have talked about this before, Annabelle, on the media, the way to weaken the media power structure is to build our own media the democratized media, where every person is part of the media, where our social networks become media outlets, where our iPhones become live stream TV stations. And when we talk to the media, we tell them. I had an interview with a couple of Washington Post reporters this week, and I said to them, you know, you guys will be better off when the workers own the Washington Post rather than a couple of the elite family that currently owns it. You'll be better off when you're not part of a big conglomerate, when the workers are focused on making the Washington Post the best paper it can be. It'll be a different paper, and you'll like it better. And so we use that democratized media format and talking to the existing media to do that. When we deal with the police, we make it clear to the police that we know they're not part of the 1%, that their lives will be better when the new world we're creating is better, is created, because policing will be better. Policing will be easier. Their families will be better off. And so, yes, our effort to stop the machine and create a new world remains a strategy, but what that means is pulling people from the power structure to our side so they can see that being part of this movement benefits them and will create a world where they have more power over their own lives.
Okay. Well, here's my biggest worry, you know, about the whole occupation movement.
Oh, my God, your biggest worry, Annabelle?
No, not you are not.
No, I want to hear your biggest worry. I'm worried now. I hope I can answer.
So the worry is, in Spain, after they had these amazing protests in Spain, basically the election went to people who are even more conservative than the government that they had when they were protesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing in Egypt is that the people who protested really couldn't assume positions of power during the transition and going forward, right?
I'll tell you the reason that's happening is we are still in the midst of these revolutions, and we have just like they had corrupt electoral system in Spain. And they have a military government system in Egypt. We have a corrupt election system here. And whether that in the short term means that a worse candidate gets in or a better candidate gets in, it almost doesn't matter, because in the end you end up with very much the same policies. Slight differences, not completely the same, but essentially you end up with a corporatized government that puts the corporation's interests first. You come up with a foreign policy of empire, because that's the foreign policy of the United States that both parties support. But,
yeah.
You know, when you're making this kind of change, it's an ongoing process. And the fact that Spain elected a more conservative government is not the final story. The organized resistance is continuing. People are still working hard to make the transformation that's needed, and that transformation will occur. And so this is just part of the process. This is the way... This is the way change occurs, and that's just it's not linear. It's not always in one direction, but it is a process, and that's what you're in the middle of.
Okay. Yeah. I hear that. I guess I just feel that it's important to think ahead. And
oh, I agree.
And I mean, to me, it's important to think ahead and sort of understand that we have to really assume positions of power, and really part of the occupation really has to be the process itself, and not become so disenchanted with the process, the current process, that we reject government altogether.
Well, I agree with that. We're not asking for a non-government situation or anarchy. But we're asking for a government where the people are ruling and not the corporations. Look at President Obama, for example. He just switched his chief of staff. He got rid of a J.P. Morgan staff and replaced him with a Citigroup chief of staff. It's almost embarrassing. When you think Rahm Emanuel was his first chief of staff, he was the most favorite congressperson from Wall Street, and he had been a trader himself and made $16 million in less than 2 years trading. You don't make $16 million and do it honestly. I got to tell you, I have a hard time believing that. But anyway, he was the most favored Wall Street Congress member. He was the funnel of money from Wall Street to Congress when he was the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He became Obama's first chief of staff. That's followed by Daley, a J.P. Morgan executive. Now you get a guy who's a former Citigroup executive. I mean, it's such a Wall Street administration. I don't see anyone who sees that corporate rule as the problem can support a president who just insists on corporate rule. It's the same as his health insurance, his health reform. Rather than challenging the root cause problem, the insurance industry, he entrenched it further. In fact, he put a woman, a executive from an insurance industry in charge of implementing his health care reform at HHS. And that same woman, by the way, wrote the Obama law working for the Finance Committee at the, in the Senate. And so what are you going to do? If you recognize that the problem is corporate power, the rule of the 1%, then you have to challenge these two parties to do better. And you don't challenge those two parties by giving them your vote. When the president just puts a Citigroup guy in charge of the White House. That's not someone that I could support. Now, I know there's people who feel differently, that they're very afraid of the Republicans, but, you know, you can have Romney versus Obama.
Okay.
You know, two Wall Street candidates.
Well, you know what? I mean, but either I can hear you saying that don't vote at all, or we need more alternatives. We need more parties. To be taken
I'm not saying don't vote at all. There are definitely alternatives. And you know, they'll be the Green Party will have Jill Stein, who's a medical doctor and really understands the issues very well. She'll be an excellent vote. Rocky Anderson is running with the Justice Party. He's a former mayor of Salt Lake City, Utah, a former Democrat, by the way, who left the party in disgust for the direction it was going. And so I'm not saying don't vote. And for most people who are voting in this country, your vote is preordained anyway. The Electoral College already tells us we're about 32 states. We do 42 states. We have already know where the vote's going. We know Maryland's going to go Democrat. We know New York's going to go Democrat. We know Idaho's going Republican. Mississippi's going Republican. So we can already predict from the vast majority of states. So your vote doesn't really matter. And what we're saying, though, is that in this election year, our job is two things. First, continue to make sure that our voices, the voice of the Occupy movement, becomes the real conversation. So that's what we're doing as part of the American Spring, the national occupation of Washington, D.C., beginning on March 30th. We're doing a social forum. A social forum is an opportunity for people to come out with their ideas, their information, and talk about the issues that concern them and really make the conversation a real conversation with the needs of the people. When we do that, we'll show that the conversation of the two corporate candidates is a fake conversation. It's a conversation of Madison Avenue. It's a conversation of focus groups and polling. It's not going to be a real conversation at all. And so that's the first thing, is to make our conversation, the people's conversation, the real conversation. The second thing is, no matter who wins the presidency, the job is going to be to push that person to represent the people's interests and not their funders' interests. We're going to have two candidates who have both received record amounts of money from Wall Street. That's whose interests are going to go first. And we're going to have to be a strong, independent movement that pushes whichever candidate gets in to do the right thing. And so our job in 2012 is to continue to build that independent movement. So those are our two tasks, control the conversation and build the independent movement. You can vote whoever you want. It doesn't really matter. It's not going to make much difference, so feel free to vote how you like. Myself, I could not vote for a corporate candidate. I'm going to vote for, and I'm in Maryland, so my vote doesn't count anyway. I'm going to vote for one of the non-corporate
I'm in Maryland,
candidates.
Too.
Well, you're free then. You can vote how you like. No fear.
Well, you know, Kevin, so just in terms of watching this, the occupation unfold and seeing it as a media story and as a political tactic, an organizing tactic, I feel like, already, there's a kind of Occupy fatigue happening in the media.
Yes. Yeah.
Not just mainstream media, but even, social media on Facebook and so on. I see kind of the waning of interest because it feels like it gets repetitive after a while. And I mean, to me, and even though, at some objective level, I mean, it is absolutely fascinating and necessary, but it's still just the way human beings are built. We can't pay attention for that long to one thing. Right? And so I guess that's one of the challenges I see going forward is in being in this business that you and I are in of trying to make significant change in our countries. Like, how do we, first of all, keep people's interest and, two, give people enough hope that they hang in there? They hang in there for the journey.
Those are really good points. and I agree with that. And I think that's why we went to phase two.
Mm-hmm.
We want to do new things to
mm-hmm.
show the movement deepening, evolving,
mm-hmm.
and showing real solutions. That's why the Occupy the Economy project is so important, because we're showing real solutions. We're showing those people who are long-term unemployed that are not even counted in the unemployment statistics, but who want to work and who have skills, who have talent, that they can come together and find a problem to solve in their community and create
mm-hmm.
a worker-owned co-op to solve that problem. They can
right.
do good and make income. So we want to try to model that for people. We're also in these houses, by the way, modeling
mm-hmm.
intentional communities. We can show people living together
mm-hmm.
in a community and, you know, with community rules and living together successfully. There's more and more house sharing going on in the United States because the middle class is shrinking. And so that's another
mm-hmm.
thing we're trying to show people hope that there are alternatives that can actually create a better life for you. And
mm-hmm.
then, of course, the movement to the American Spring and the expansion of the Occupy movement, with all occupiers being invited to Washington, D.C. to participate, and we'll show
mm-hmm.
the depth and breadth of the movement. I think that will once again gather media attention, as will the social forum, showing that the Occupy movement
mm-hmm.
actually has solutions. There are these
yeah.
people who are discussing the real problems and trying to find real solutions. So I think we have to, in order to keep the attention and
mm-hmm.
keep the hope up, we have to evolve and get better ourselves.
So the solutions that you're proposing sound like local non-governmental solutions, co-ops, community solutions.
Some of the solutions, that's right. And I mean, there
mm-hmm.
there's need for government to take action too. And when we talk about the goal of this movement, as I see it, is
mm-hmm.
really create a participatory democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not just in our electoral and our government actions, but also economy. Participatory
mm-hmm.
democracy, where you can participate in the economy. And
yeah.
if you look, Mark and I have an organization called It's Our Economy. It'sourEconomy.us is the website. And if you look on that, you can put in the word democratized economy. You can see there's a whole range of different things. Community
mm-hmm.
banks, for example, are part of a democratized economy, as are credit unions. We talk about shifting corporate welfare and turning it into taxpayer investment. So when
mm-hmm.
taxpayers invest in a business, we get a share of the profit. And there's a whole series of things that need to be done both at a governmental level and an individual level outside the government. And we do want to show what can be done outside the government now, because the government's so corrupt and so dysfunctional that we don't expect the kind of changes that we need to come from the government in the immediate future. We have to weaken those pillars that hold the status quo in place before we can expect the government to do anything to really solve our problems.
Mm-hmm. I just find it interesting, though, that the solutions that are coming forward are non-governmental solutions that are focused more in local communities and so on, that could really align with a lot of conservatives who have had that philosophy for some time, that we shouldn't look to government to solve our problems, right?
That's right.
In a very positive way, I feel like there could be a lot of people who would like those solutions, regardless of where they fit in with their parties or their ideology, the current ideologies.
Really good point. I think that's exactly right. It is empowering, too.
Mm-hmm,
people
absolutely.
Can make this change themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, I know you have probably gone through some incredible personal challenges being part of this occupation, and it's going through just probably testing yourself, testing your physical limits and your kind of spiritual limits. I'm just kind of curious to hear about some of the things that you've learned beginning October, since you started the occupation. Like, Margaret told me that you don't actually like camping, for instance.
I actually don't like camping, and so spending more than 2 months in a tent is not my cup of tea. And doing so on a public park on Pennsylvania Avenue certainly makes it even worse. It's not quite Yellowstone, you know. But on the other hand, what I found were a few things that were really interesting. First off, I saw many of the people on the plaza going through personal transformations.
Mm-hmm.
Finding for some people the first time a sense of real family, and for others, a real sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with that, you know, with your family and community, there also turns out to be some challenges because you get to know those people so well and their foibles and their problems. You know, so you know how families are, right?
Yes,
and so you have to deal with, you have to deal with that stuff. And, you know, you also test yourself in that our natural instinct, you know, is to try to care for people.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's the instinct of a lot of people at Freedom Plaza. And so we invite the homeless for dinner, you know, early on. And when we did that, we discovered that with the homeless came problems that our society is not dealing with very well. Addiction problems, mental illness problems, alcoholism, and problems that actually we were not capable of dealing with very well. We tried for several weeks in this process to deal, cope with those problems, and we really discovered we weren't capable of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to come up with principles. What do we stand for, and why are we here, and what are the rules, essentially, for being part of this community? And I think that was a very important a lesson for us. And if you look at this article on OccupyWashingtonDC.org about where we came from and where we're going, we list those principles. And, you know, what was great about that was an open General Assembly discussion about developing those principles. And as we openly discussed it, some of the homeless who were in our encampment started to recognize we wanted them to participate. We wanted them to take on responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And they started to take on responsibility, whether it was volunteering at our health tent or washing dishes or going on marches, speaking out at the General Assembly, whatever it was they were interested in, and they started to participate. It was fantastic to see, and made them much happier, too.
Mm-hmm.
Made them much happier, too. So I think that's really what I've seen about this whole plaza, this whole public occupation experience, is transformation. To transform society, we have to transform ourselves first, and that's really quite something to see.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally sympathize with that. I mean, I'm just wondering, in terms, just thinking very practically here, I mean, when do you think you're going to be able to say, okay, we achieved our goals, we've done enough?
I think this is probably a 10 to 20 year project. Not that we'll be occupying Freedom Plaza for 10 to 20 years, but that this is the beginning. We always saw Freedom Plaza as a tactic, as a first step to developing an independent movement that would challenge existing institutions and government and the economy to change, to radically change. And so we don't see this as something that's going to end the occupation of Freedom Plaza ending with a victory. It will have some, it already has had victories, but it's not going to end with our final victory. It's the beginning of a social movement that's independent of the two parties and challenges the system. And so we'll leave Freedom Plaza, but I suspect that we're going to be pushing this issue and fighting this issue for quite a time. If you know, another thing on the Occupy Washington, D.C. page is an article by Bill Moyers,
mm-hmm.
about the Powell memo, P-O-W-E-L-L, Justice Lewis Powell,
mm-hmm.
wrote a memo in 1971 before he was a Supreme Court justice about how the corporations could take control of government, of universities, of
mm-hmm.
media, of other institutions, that of journals, et cetera. And it was a plan for a corporate takeover.
Yeah.
And they've been working on that for 40 years. And Moyers describes how that was implemented and how the Chamber of Commerce doubled in size within a year, how major corporations got together to implement the plan, including ABC and CBS and General Electric and AT&T, this is back in 1971, and how they implemented that plan to take over. So we have a 40-year history of corporate power taking over. Now we have to untangle that history. And so our work is going to be a long-term effort, not a short-term one, and I see it as probably a 10- to 20-year project.
Wow. Okay, so you have to be able to say, okay, we're making progress here. And
oh yeah.
I know that you already feel that there's been tremendous amount of progress, and absolutely, it's just amazing the amount of progress that's been made since October. What are sort of the incremental things that you're ticking off, saying this is progress, like, and
well,
how can we help you? Yeah,
I think the things that I see that have been progress so far, and one is just public opinion changing. It's really been interesting to see the polls shifting to Americans recognizing the wealth divide and recognizing the wealth divide and the unfair economy is caused by policies that intentionally help the 1%. That's a major change. And I think that's a big victory in itself. Another major change I think would be very important.
That's a huge victory. Mm-hmm.
A huge victory. I mean, I think education is the first step toward transformation, and so that educational effort is major. The second, I think, thing that I really am pleased with is, you know, we had that super committee up on Capitol Hill that was supposed to solve the deficit problem, and all the indications were, before the Occupy movement began, that super committee was going toward cutting Social Security and cutting Medicare, even though neither one of those affect the deficit because they both have their own lines of taxation to fund them. They don't cause deficit problems. There was no question that the Obama administration and the Republicans were moving toward cutting those programs. I think it was because of the Occupy movement. We had protests, by the way, inside the super committee, in the hallway outside the super committee, in the building outside where the super committee was meeting. We had our own super committee meeting on Freedom Plaza. We put out our own super committee report, the Occupy super committee report. We called the 99% deficit reduction plan. You can see it on Occupy Washington, D.C. I think because of all that, we stopped the super committee from doing anything. We stopped them from cutting these critical programs that provide essential services and are essentially were a contract to the people. The contract is, we take money out of your paycheck, every paycheck for Medicare, for your health care when you're older, and for your retirement and Social Security when you're older, and you get those when you're 65. And that contract was going to be broken. But I think the Occupy movement prevented that. The people in power knew if they had gone that route, the Occupy movement would have exploded and would have become much bigger very quickly. So I think we have already had that impact. And I think when we, in the American Spring, if we are able to bring many more people to Washington, D.C., literally, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of people, we will even have a bigger people. So I think the other thing that we've, the other victory is people are seeing they have power. And that is gigantic because we are taught in this country we cannot fight City Hall. We have no power. The corporations rule. The money rules. People have no voice. You're going to be ignored. And we have shown them that, in fact, we have power. And that's so critical.
Yeah. So, I mean, don't you think right there you're saying that, we've been complicitive in the corporate takeover of our government, and that part of what would lead to the shift in power is that we stop being complicitive because we're not aware that we are. And so they have power to me as long as they can convince us to obey them and to accept the propaganda that they're making.
That's exactly right. We have much more power than we realize. The government could not run without us. The economy could not run without us. The airplanes could not run without everyone from the steward and stewardess to the pilot and the air traffic controller. The cities could not run without the taxi drivers and the metros. And the police are critical. And the fire. We all have power.
Yeah.
The elites cannot do all this stuff. They don't know how to run any of this stuff. We have the power to run this stuff. And we have to understand that power, and we have to be not afraid of that power. And we also have the power not to vote for either corporate party. That's a power that many people are afraid of because we are manipulated so much in the voting system because of the greater evil, the fear of the greater evil. And whether if you're a Republican, you fear the greater evil Democrat. If you're a Democrat, you fear the greater evil Republican. And there's storylines for both those, And so we've got to get over our fear.
Yeah, but I guess where I'm a little hesitant to just embrace that is I feel like the party is whoever is participating in that party. So if we can get people like us to actually run for office and get elected right now, then the parties were changed dramatically.
Well, the problem with that is that you're not really looking honestly at the system. First off, the system prevents you from running and getting elected. Even if you run within the Democratic Party, the Progressive, you will have the party against you. And so, first off, and if you run outside the two parties, forget it. You're not going to be covered by the media. You may not even get on the ballot. And so the system is stacked against honest elections.
I think it's a critical mass problem, though. I mean, if we can get a critical mass number of people.
Well, the second point I was going to make was that this has been tried. Taking over a party from the inside has been tried. And you can see it with the four Tea Party people who thought they were going to be revolutionary, and they're going to get Mitt Romney. So much for that revolution. They've been co-opted by the Republicans, and now they're going to be supporting Mitt Romney. How embarrassing. On the Democratic side, much bigger institutions have tried to change the Democratic Party when it was much less of a money-dominated party. When the unions got involved in the Democratic Party in the 1940s, they thought they could move the party to their direction. And instead, you've seen union membership dropping and dropping and dropping, almost to irrelevancy. The unions if the unions instead took their own position and said, we are independent two parties, Democrats, you want our vote, you have to earn our vote. And we're not going to earn it by words. are earned by actions. That means you don't put Citigroup in to replace J.P. Morgan, in to replace the corporate whore, Rahm Emanuel. You know, that's not acceptable to us. And instead, unions are going to give it up for nothing. And so it's failed. That approach has failed.
Well, you know what? I mean, I guess we're just going to have to disagree there because I feel like things are different now. That things like social media and
the Tea Party showed you how different they are. Mitt Romney's going to be their representative. You know,
right.
He's the opposite of what they stand for.
Yeah, but I think they could have done things differently. Not, for instance, not from early on follow work with FreedomWorks and other inside the Beltway organizations that ended up having too much power over them. You know what I mean?
Well, we've done our best in the Occupy movement to resist that. We've been pushed by Move On and Campaign for America's Future and Rebuild the Green. They've tried to co-opt us, and we've been so far successfully preventing that. But they are trying to do that, and they'll keep trying to do that. And it's something we have to be on the outlook for. I agree. That's a big mistake to be co-opted by those kinds of groups.
Yeah. Well, so I don't want to, you know, keep you forever, even though I have tons more questions. But I do want to say that, I want to give you a chance to kind of really explain to us how we can help. Like, just give us
specific
things you can do.
Go to OccupyWashingtonDC.org, sign up, be part of our web community. And, we just put an article up about next steps of the Occupy movement, you know, where we go from here. It's on the top of our homepage. It's by Margaret Flowers and me. And you can comment on that and give us your thoughts. We want people to add their ideas, participate in discussion. We think one of the great strengths of the Occupy movement is that it is a democratized movement. And so we want to see that carried on our website. So get involved that way. You can also know that money is definitely needed. It costs us about $12,000 a month to keep this operation going. With the cold weather coming, there's less people coming to Freedom Plaza, so there's less cash coming in. So any help with that, any small amount of help with that is always helpful. And recognize this movement is your movement, and participate. Plan to come out on March 30th, and you don't have to be there the whole time, but you can come and go. Come for the weekends, come for part of the time. You know, just be part of that movement. This is a movement for the people, and you are the people, and it's our job to work to create a more perfect union. That's what citizenship is about. We, the people, to form a more perfect union. So please get involved online and in person and join us.
Okay. Well, thanks, Kevin. And
I'll come visit you guys and say
hello to Margaret and everyone out there for me. Thank you.
I will. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Hey there, everyone. Well, that was interesting. if you guys want to chat for a little bit right now, just press 1. I know some of you have called and on Switchboard. It doesn't look like you have pressed 1. So, so feel free to do that now if you want to process all the stuff that we just heard in the last hour. I did start the show. Okay, on Sundays. Every Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, I'm going to have kind of my call-in show for 90 minutes to kind of reflect on the week and then figure out, sort of look forward to the next week. And we're going to have a focus or a theme for each show, even though we're going to try to keep it as open as possible. Like on New Year's, we did one sort of about New Year's and looking back on 2011. And last year was really about, what's it going to take? You know, we were really focused on trying to ask big picture questions. This Sunday, I'm going to focus on the whole issue of the growing poverty in America and the fact that we are living through a very difficult time. CBS is doing this amazing show, a series called The Hard Times Generation, focused on the growing poverty in America, and especially on the children, the plight of the children, 14 million children that are in poverty, families living in cars, and so on. And this is something that I feel like a lot of people are not grasping, just how bad things are. And I've been getting emails and messages from people who want to share their stories. So I think it's going to be an amazing show Sunday at 5 p.m., so I hope you can join. I have a caller, 360 number. Hey there.
Hi, Annabelle. This is Don Manning in Washington State.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing good. I was listening in on your two guests there, and just some comments. The first gentleman you were talking to there about the Citizens United and, you know, and what went on in Montana and whatnot. John, is it Boniface?
Boniface, yeah.
Yeah, And as you probably know, when Eric comes out on the 23rd, pretty much our whole focus of that meeting is him and several other speakers are going to pretty much cover the, you know, history of the Citizens United and corporations, you know, being given personhood and whatnot. And I think that, you know, anybody that's listening in that's not really up on it, if, you know, your guest didn't really touch on Citizens United themselves, you know, what they are. And if you, you know, if you go to their website and you just start, you know, just read the first paragraph of what they say, who they are, that is pretty revealing right there of, you know, what's going on. And it's all about, you know, corporate power, although you wouldn't see that by reading their description of themselves. But, you know, that Newt Gingrich just saw firsthand, you know, he helped bring this about. And yet he was on the receiving end of, you know, some PAC money in Iowa with, you know, what he called dirty campaign ads. And, you know, that's the other part of this Citizens United that doesn't get talked about that much is what's being allowed is all this undisclosed massive amounts of cash going into these PACs that are, you know, not connected to the candidates directly, but they're supporters of theirs that remain anonymous. And you know, we're going to end up with the best legislation and democracy that money can buy. And that said about Citizens United, your last guest, I've just got one concern that seems to surface now and again with people in the Occupy movement, and I think you might have touched on it a little bit there too. You know, some of the people that I've talked to involved in Occupy are of the opinion that they're so fed up with the system that they don't want to use the power of the vote to try to make a difference in some of these elections if they don't like the choices that look like they're available or electable, I should say. And so, you know, consequently, they don't have the attitude of the lesser of two evils or what's the best scenario, what's the worst. It's like they're like, you know, see none of the above. And that's a dangerous slope to be on, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I hear, I'm sympathetic to what they're saying. I don't agree with Kevin and that whole attitude. I mean, but he did point out that he's looking for alternatives. That's why he mentioned the Justice Party and some other candidates. But I think there's a difference of opinion about how bad things are and just how corrupt the two parties are and so on. And so he, based on his experience, I mean, he feels like it's so bad that he's looking for candidates that really are way out there, you know, calling for pretty radical change as opposed to candidates from the two major parties. So, you know, I think it's a question of degree.
You know, and I can understand too where he's coming from, but maybe it's because you know, I'm older and probably won't see as many election cycles ahead as he will. But you know, this is kind of like climbing a really slippery, tough mountain, and you know, you've got a foothold, and why go backwards if even that next step is going to be difficult? You're still making progress. And, you know, get another foothold, you know, get a little bit higher up that mountain and, you know, keep on moving up and not go lateral or backwards. So
you are so coffee party.
What's that?
You are so coffee party.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah, we're just a little more practical and less, I think, utopian.
Yeah.
It's one way of putting it is we have to use some common sense here and get a little practical. I mean, yeah, we want to have big changes, but we're not going to have political utopia right now. I don't know
right.
when it's going to ever really happen, but we have to do what's, I think, responsible. You know, we can't renege on our responsibility. So, I mean, I feel that's essentially a difference that I have with Kevin. And not everyone in Occupy shares what Kevin is saying either. But he's definitely expressing a very popular opinion from the Occupy movement, right?
Yeah,
but I think we have to stand firmly on the side of we have to occupy our process, our democracy, and our government, and do our part as citizens, and accept the blame too that we have been complicit in having this situation grow out of control, where corporations now have too much power over our government, and people are marginalized. I mean, we're part of the problem, and I guess that's what I want to emphasize with people like Kevin. But Kevin and I have been having this conversation back and forth for a little while now. But thanks for calling in, Don, to share.
You bet.
Thanks
a lot.
I enjoy
try to get on there whenever I can when you have something going. So
you have a great voice, by the way. So I'm welcome you to call anytime. And good luck on your event. I know Eric's really looking forward to it. Eric just said see you soon. He's in the background here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I said hi. Yeah, well, it looks like I'm going on a little local internet radio show starting next Sunday, too, for an hour and a half. So I'll tell you more about that when I get it going.
Oh, good. Yeah, just, I mean, that's one thing Kevin and I agree on is, like, we have to create our own media. And so, like, produce content. Don't wait for media. Go create media. Yeah.
I agree.
Okay, well, thanks for calling in, Don.
We'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye. So thanks for joining, everyone. I will be back on Sunday at 5, and feel free to call me. You can email me at enough@coffeepartyusa.com, and, you can volunteer, you can suggest topics, give me feedback or whatnot. I'm trying to improve the sound situation, sound quality, so I don't know if it sounded better today. I'll look into it. But I'll be back on Sunday, and thanks for joining. Take care.